Harper Audio presents American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history, by Chris Kyle, with Scott McEwen and Jim DeFelice. Read by John Pruden. Author's note: the things that happened in this book are true, recounted from the best of my memory. We've reconstructed dialogue from memory, which means that it may not be word for word, but the essence of what was said is accurate. During my career, I participated in a number of operations that continue to be classified for national security reasons. They are not included in this account. No classified information was used in the preparation of this book. Many of the people I served with are still active duty SEALs. Others are working in different capacities for the government, protecting our nation. All may be considered enemies by our country's enemies, as am I. Because of that, I have not given their full identities in this book. They know who they are, and I hope they know they have my thanks. C.K. Prologue. Evil in the Crosshairs. Late March 2003, in the area of Nasiriya, Iraq. I looked through the scope of the sniper rifle, scanning down the road of the tiny Iraqi town. 50 yards away, a woman opened the door of a small house and stepped outside with her child. The rest of the street was deserted. The local Iraqis had gone inside, most of them scared. A few curious souls peeked out from behind curtains, waiting. They could hear the rumble of the approaching American unit. The Marines were flooding up the road, marching north to liberate the country from Saddam Hussein. It was my job to protect them. My platoon had taken over the building earlier in the day, sneaking into position to provide overwatch, prevent the enemy from ambushing the Marines as they came through. It didn't seem like too difficult a task. If anything, I was glad the Marines were on my side. I'd seen the power of their weapons, and I would have hated to have to fight them. The Iraq army didn't stand a chance, and, in fact, they appeared to have abandoned the area already. The war had started roughly 2 weeks before. My platoon, Charlie, later Cadillac, of SEAL Team 3, helped kick it off during the early morning of March 20. We landed on Alfaw Peninsula and secured the oil terminal there so Saddam couldn't set it ablaze as he had during the first Gulf War. Now we were tasked to assist the Marines as they marched north toward Baghdad. I was a SEAL, a Navy commando trained in special operations. SEAL stands for Sea, Air, Land, and it pretty much describes the wide ranges of places we operate. In this case, we were far inland, much farther than SEALs traditionally operated, though as the war against terror continued, this would become common. I'd spent nearly 3 years training and learning how to become a warrior. I was ready for this fight, or at least as ready as anyone can be. The rifle I was holding was a 300 Win Mag, a bolt-action precision sniper weapon that belonged to my platoon chief. He'd been covering the street for a while and needed a break. He showed a great deal of confidence in me by choosing me to spot him and take the gun. I was still a new guy, a newbie or rookie in the teams. By SEAL standards, I had yet to be fully tested. I was also not yet trained as a SEAL sniper. I wanted to be one in the worst way, but I had a long way to go. Giving me the rifle that morning was the chief's way of testing me to see if I had the right stuff. We were on the roof of an old run-down building at the edge of a town the Marines were going to pass through. The wind kicked dirt and papers across the battered road below us. The place smelled like a sewer. The stench of Iraq was one thing I'd never get used to. "Marines are coming," said my chief as the building began to shake. "Keep watching." I looked through the scope. The only people who were moving were the woman and maybe a child or two nearby. I watched our troops pull up. 10 young, proud Marines in uniform got out of their vehicles and gathered for a foot patrol. As the Americans organized, the woman took something from beneath her clothes and yanked at it. She'd set a grenade. I didn't realize it at first. "Looks yellow," I told the chief, describing what I saw as he watched himself. "It's yellow. The body..." She's got a grenade, said the chief. That's a Chinese grenade.
Shit.
Take a shot.
But...
Shoot. Get the grenade. The Marines.
I hesitated. Someone was trying to get the Marines on the radio, but we couldn't reach them. They were coming down the street, headed toward the woman.
Shoot, said the chief. I pushed my finger against the trigger. The bullet leapt out. I shot. The grenade dropped. I fired again as the grenade blew up. It was the first time I'd killed anyone while I was on the sniper rifle, and the first time in Iraq, and the only time I killed anyone other than a male combatant. It was my duty to shoot, and I don't regret it. The woman was already dead. I was just making sure she didn't take any Marines with her. It was clear that not only did she want to kill them, but she didn't care about anybody else nearby who would have been blown up by the grenade or killed in the firefight. Children on the street, people in the houses, maybe her child. She was too blinded by evil to consider them. She just wanted Americans dead, no matter what. My shots saved several Americans, whose lives were clearly worth more than that woman's twisted soul. I can stand before God with a clear conscience about doing my job, but I truly, deeply hated the evil that woman possessed. I hate it to this day. Savage, despicable evil. That's what we were fighting in Iraq. That's why a lot of people, myself included, called the enemy savages. There really was no other way to describe what we encountered there. People ask me all the time, how many people have you killed? My standard response is, does the answer make me less or more of a man? The number is not important to me. I only wish I had killed more. Not for bragging rights, but because I believe the world is a better place without savages out there taking American lives. Everyone I shot in Iraq was trying to harm Americans or Iraqis loyal to the new government. I had a job to do as a SEAL. I killed the enemy, an enemy I saw day in and day out plotting to kill my fellow Americans. I'm haunted by the enemy's successes. They were few, but even a single American life is one too many lost. I don't worry about what other people think of me. It's one of the things I most admired about my dad growing up. He didn't give a hoot what others thought. He was who he was. It's one of the qualities that has kept me most sane. As this book goes to print, I'm still a bit uncomfortable with the idea of publishing my life story. First of all, I've always thought that if you want to know what life as a SEAL is like, you should go get your own trident, earn our medal, the symbol of who we are. Go through our training, make the sacrifices, physical and mental. That's the only way you'll know. Second of all, and more importantly, who cares about my life? I'm no different than anyone else. I happen to have been in some pretty badass situations. People have told me it's interesting. I don't see it. Other people are talking about writing books about my life or about some of the things I've done. I find it strange, but I also feel it's my life and my story, and I guess I better be the one to get it on paper the way it actually happened. Also, there are a lot of people who deserve credit, and if I don't write the story, they may be overlooked. I don't like the idea of that at all. My boys deserve to be praised more than I do. The Navy credits me with more kills as a sniper than any other American service member, past or present. I guess that's true. They go back and forth on what the number is. One week, it's 160, the official number as of this writing, for what that's worth. Then it's way higher. Then it's somewhere in between. If you want a number, ask the Navy. You may even get the truth if you catch them on the right day. People always want a number. Even if the Navy would let me, I'm not going to give one. I'm not a numbers guy. SEALs are silent warriors, and I'm a SEAL down to my soul. If you want the whole story, get a trident. If you want to check me out, ask a SEAL. If you want what I'm comfortable with sharing,
and even some stuff I'm reluctant to reveal. Keep listening. I've always said that I wasn't the best shot or even the best sniper ever. I'm not denigrating my skills. I certainly worked hard to hone them. I was blessed with some excellent instructors who deserve a lot of credit. And my boys, the fellow SEALs and the Marines and the Army soldiers who fought with me and helped me do my job, were all a critical part of my success. But my high total and my so-called legend have much to do with the fact that I was in the shit a lot. In other words, I had more opportunities than most. I served back-to-back deployments from right before the Iraq War kicked off until the time I got out in 2009. I was lucky enough to be positioned directly in the action. There's another question people ask a lot. Did it bother you killing so many people in Iraq? I tell them, nope. And I mean it. The first time you shoot someone, you get a little nervous. You think, can I really shoot this guy? Is it really okay? But after you kill your enemy, you see it's okay. You say, great. You do it again and again. You do it so the enemy won't kill you or your countrymen. You do it until there's no one left for you to kill. That's what war is. I loved what I did. I still do. If circumstances were different, if my family didn't need me, I'd be back in a heartbeat. I'm not lying or exaggerating to say it was fun. I had the time of my life being a SEAL. People try to put me in a category as a badass, a good old boy, asshole, sniper, SEAL, and probably other categories not appropriate to repeat here. All might be true on any given day. In the end, my story, in Iraq and afterward, is about more than just killing people or even fighting for my country. It's about being a man, and it's about love as well as hate. 1. Bustin' Bronx and Other Ways of Having Fun. Just a cowboy at heart. Every story has a beginning. Mine starts in North Central Texas. I grew up in small towns where I learned the importance of family and traditional values like patriotism, self-reliance, and watching out for your family and neighbors. I'm proud to say that I still try to live my life according to those values. I have a strong sense of justice. It's pretty much black and white. I don't see too much gray. I think it's important to protect others. I don't mind hard work. At the same time, I like to have fun. Life's too short not to. I was raised with and still believe in the Christian faith. If I had to order my priorities, they would be God, country, family. There might be some debate on where those last two fall. These days I've come around to believing that family may, under some circumstances, outrank country, but it's a close race. I've always loved guns, always loved hunting, and in a way I guess you could say I've always been a cowboy. I was riding horses from the time I could walk. I wouldn't call myself a true cowboy today, because it's been a long time since I've worked a ranch, and I've probably lost a lot of what I had in the saddle. Still, in my heart, if I'm not a SEAL, I'm a cowboy, or should be. Problem is, it's a hard way to make a living when you have a family. I don't remember when I started hunting, but it would have been when I was very young. My family had a deer lease a few miles from our house, and we would hunt every winter. For you Yankees, a deer lease is a property where the owner rents or leases hunting rights out for a certain amount of time. You pay your money, and you get the right to go out and hunt. Y'all probably have different arrangements where you live, but this one is pretty common down here. Besides deer, we'd hunt turkey, doves, quail, whatever was in season. We meant my mom, my dad, and my brother, who's 4 years younger than me. We'd spend the weekends in an old RV trailer. It wasn't very big, but we were a tight little family, and we had a lot of fun. My father worked for Southwestern Bell and AT&T. They split and then came back together over the length of his career. He was a manager, and as he'd get promoted, we'd have to move every few years. So, in a way, I was raised all over Texas. Even though he was successful, my father hated his job. Not the work, really, but what went along with it. the bureaucracy, the fact that he had to work in an office. He really hated having to wear a suit and tie every day. "I don't care how much money you get," my dad used to tell me. "It's not worth it if you're not happy." That's the most valuable piece of advice he ever gave me. Do what you want in life. To this day, I've tried to follow that philosophy. In a lot of ways, my father was my best friend growing up, but he was able at the same time to combine that with a good dose of fatherly discipline. There was a line, and I never wanted to cross it. I got my share of whoopings, you Yankees will call them spankings, when I deserved it, but not to excess, and never in anger. If my dad was mad, he'd give himself a few minutes to calm down before administering a controlled whooping, followed by a hug. To hear my brother tell it, he and I were at each other's throats most of the time. I don't know if that's true, but we did have our share of tussles. He was younger and smaller than me, but he could give as good as he got, and he'd never give up. He's a tough character, and one of my closest friends to this day. We gave each other hell, but we also had a lot of fun, and always knew we had each other's back. Our high school used to have a statue of a panther in the front lobby. We had a tradition each year where seniors would try and put incoming freshmen on the panther as a hazing ritual. Freshmen naturally resisted. I had graduated when my brother became a freshman, but I came back on his first day of school and offered $100 to anyone who could sit him on that statue. I still have that $100. While I got into a lot of fights, I didn't start most of them. My dad made it clear I'd get a whooping if he found out I started a fight. We were supposed to be above that. Defending myself was a different story. Protecting my brother was even better. If someone tried to pick on him, I'd lay them out. I was the only one allowed to whip him. Somewhere along the way, I started sticking up for younger kids who were getting picked on. I felt I had to look out for them. It became my duty. Maybe it began because I was looking for an excuse to fight without getting into trouble. I think there was more to it than that. I think my father's sense of justice and fair play influenced me more than I knew at the time, and even more than I can say as an adult. But whatever the reason, it sure gave me plenty of opportunities for getting into scrapes. My family had a deep faith in God. My dad was a deacon, and my mom taught Sunday school. I remember a stretch when I was young when we would go to church every Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday evening. Still, we didn't consider ourselves overly religious, just good people who believed in God and were involved in our church. Truth is, back then, I didn't like going a lot of the time. My dad worked hard. I suspect it was in his blood. His father was a Kansas farmer, and those people worked hard. One job was never enough for my dad. He had a feed store for a bit when I was growing up, and we had a pretty modest-sized ranch we all worked to keep going. He's retired now, officially, but you can still find him working for a local veterinarian when he's not tending to things on his small ranch. My mother was also a really hard worker. When my brother and I were old enough to be on our own, she went to work as a counselor at a juvenile detention center. It was a rough job, dealing with difficult kids all day long, and eventually she moved on. She's retired now, too, though she keeps herself busy with part-time work and her grandchildren. Ranching helped fill out my school days. My brother and I would have our different chores after school and on the weekends. Feed and look after the horses, ride through the cattle, inspect the fences. Cattle always give you problems. I've been kicked in the leg, kicked in the chest, and yes, kicked where the sun doesn't shine. Never been kicked in the head, though. That might have set me straight. Growing up, I raised steers and heifers for FFA. Future Farmers of America. The name is now officially the National FFA Organization. I loved FFA and spent a lot of time grooming and showing cattle, even though dealing with the animals could be frustrating. I'd get pissed off at them and think I was king of the world. When all else failed, I was known to whack them upside their huge hard heads to knock some sense into them. Twice I broke my hand. Like I said, getting hit in the skull may have set me straight. I kept my head when it came to guns, but I was still passionate about them. Like a lot of boys, my first weapon was a Daisy multi-pump BB rifle. The more you pumped, the more powerful your shot. Later on, I had a CO2-powered revolver that looked like the old 1860 Peacemaker Colt model. I've been partial to Old West firearms ever since, and after getting out of the Navy, I've started collecting some very fine-looking replicas. My favorite is an 1861 Colt Navy revolver replica manufactured on the old lathes. I got my first real rifle when I was 7 or 8 years old. It was a bolt-action 30-06. It was a solid gun, so grown up that it scared me to shoot it first. I came to love that gun, but as I recall, what I really lusted after was my brother's Marlin 30-30. It was lever-action, cowboy style. Yes, there was a theme there. Bronco busting. You're not a cowboy until you can break a horse. I started learning when I was in high school. At first, I didn't know a whole heck of a lot. It was just, hop on them and ride them until they quit bucking. Do your best to stay on. I learned much more as I got older, but most of my early education came on the job, or on the horse, so to speak. The horse would do something, and I would do something. Together, we came to an understanding. Probably the most important lesson was patience. I wasn't a patient person by nature. I had to develop that talent working with horses. It would end up being extremely valuable when I became a sniper, and even when I was courting my wife. Unlike cattle, I never found a reason to smack a horse. Ride 'em till I wore 'em out, sure. Stay on them till they realized who was boss, absolutely. But hit a horse? Never saw a reason good enough. Horses are smarter than cattle. You can work a horse into cooperating if you give it enough time and patience. I don't know if I exactly had a talent for breaking horses or not, but being around them fed my appetite for all things cowboy. So, looking back, it isn't very surprising that I got involved in rodeo competitions while still in school. I played sports in high school, baseball and football, but nothing compared with the excitement of the rodeo. Every high school has its different cliques, jocks, nerds, and so on. The crew I was hanging out with were the ropers. We had the boots and jeans, and in general looked and acted like cowboys. I wasn't a real roper. I couldn't have lassoed a calf worth a lick at that point. But that didn't stop me from getting involved in rodeos around age 16. I started out by riding bulls and horses at a small local place where you paid $20 to ride as long as you could stay on. You would have to supply your own gear, spurs, chaps, your rigging. There was nothing fancy about it. You got on and fell off, and got on again. Gradually, I stayed on longer and longer, and finally got to the point where I felt confident enough to enter some small local rodeos. Busting a bull is a little different than taming a horse. They buck forward, but their skin is so loose that when they're going forward, you not only go forward, but you slip side to side, and bulls can really spin. Let me put it this way. Staying on top of a bull is not an easy matter. I rode bulls for about a year without a ton of success. Wising up, I went to horses and ended up trying saddle bronc busting. This is the classic event where you not only have to stay on the horse for 8 seconds, but also do so with style and finesse. For some reason, I did a lot better in this event than the others, and so I kept with it for quite a while, winning my share of belt buckles and more than one fancy saddle. Not that I was a champion, mind you, but I did well enough to spread some prize money around the bar. I also got some attention from the Buckle Bunnies, rodeo's version of female groupies. It was all good. I enjoyed going from city to city, traveling, partying, and riding. Call it the cowboy lifestyle. I continued riding after I graduated high school in 1992 and started going to college at Tarleton State University in Stephenville, Texas. For those of you who don't know it, Tarleton was founded in 1899 and joined the Texas A&M University system in 1917. They're the third largest non-land-grant agricultural university in the country. The school has a reputation for turning out excellent ranch and farm managers, as well as agricultural education teachers. At the time, I was interested in becoming a ranch manager. Before enrolling, though, I had given some thought to the military. My mom's dad had been an Army Air Force pilot, and for a while I thought of becoming an aviator. Then I considered becoming a Marine. I wanted to see real action. I liked the idea of fighting. I also heard a bit about special operations and thought about joining Marine Recon, which is the Corps' elite special warfare unit. But my family, Mom especially, wanted me to go to college. Eventually, I saw it their way. I decided I would go to school first, then join the military. Heck, the way I looked at it, doing that meant I could party for a while before getting down to business. I was still doing rodeo and getting fairly good at it. But my career ended abruptly around the end of my freshman year when a Bronco flipped over on me in a chute at a competition in Rendon, Texas. The guys watching me couldn't open the chute because of the way the horse came down, so they had to pull him back over on top of me. I still had one foot in the stirrup and was dragged and kicked so hard I lost consciousness. I woke up in a life flight helicopter flying to the hospital. I ended up with pins in my wrists, a dislocated shoulder, broken ribs, and a bruised lung and kidney. Probably the worst part of the recovery was the dang pins. They were actually big screws about a quarter inch thick. They stuck out a few inches on either side of my wrist, just like on Frankenstein's monster. They itched and looked strange, but they held my hands together. A few weeks after I was hurt, I decided it was time to call up a girl I'd been wanting to take out. I wasn't about to let the pins get in the way of a good time. We were driving along, and one of the long metal screws kept hitting the signal indicator as I was driving. It pissed me off so bad, I ended up breaking it off at the base close to my skin. I don't guess she was too impressed with that. The date ended early. My rodeo career was over, but I continued partying like I was on tour. I ran through my money pretty quickly, and so I started looking for work after school. I found a job in a lumber yard as a delivery guy, dropping off wood and other materials. I was a decent worker, and I guess it showed. One day a fella came in and started talking to me. "I know a guy who owns a ranch, and he's looking for a hired hand," he said. "I wonder if you'd be interested." "Holy hell," I told him, "I'll go out there right now." And so I became a ranch hand, a real cowboy, even though I was still going to school full time. Life as a cowboy. I went to work for David Landrum in Hood County, Texas, and quickly found out I wasn't near as much of a cowboy as I thought I was. David took care of that. He taught me everything about working a ranch, and then some. He was a rough man. He would cuss you up one side and down the other. If you were doing good, he wouldn't say a word. But I ended up really liking the guy. Working on a ranch is heaven. It's a hard life, featuring plenty of hard work, and yet at the same time, it's an easy life. You're outside all the time. Most days, it's just you and the animals. You don't have to deal with people or offices or any petty bullshit. You just do your job. David Spread ran 10,000 acres. It was a real ranch, very old school. We even had a chuck wagon during the spring roundup season. I want to tell you, this was a beautiful place, with gentle hills, a couple of creeks, and open land that made you feel alive every time you looked at it. The heart of the ranch was an old house that had probably been a way station, an inn in Yankee speak back in the 19th century. It was a majestic building with screened porches front and back, nice-sized rooms inside, and a big fireplace that warmed the soul as well as the skin. Of course, because I was a ranch hand, my quarters were a little more primitive. I had what we called a bunkhouse, which was barely big enough for an actual bunk. It might have measured 6 by 12 feet, and my bed took up most of that. There wasn't space for drawers. I had to hang all my clothes, including my underwear, on a pole. The walls weren't insulated. Central Texas can be pretty cold in the winter, and even with the gas stove on high and electric heater right next to the bed, I slept with my clothes on. But the worst thing about it was the fact that there wasn't a proper foundation under the floorboards. I was continually doing battle with raccoons and armadillos who'd burrow in right under my bed. Those raccoons were ornery and audacious. I must have shot 20 of them before they finally got the message that they weren't welcome under my house. I started out riding the tractors, planting wheat for the cattle in the wintertime. I moved on to sloughing feed to the cattle. Eventually, David determined I was likely to stick around and started giving me more responsibilities. He bumped my salary to $400 a month. After my last class ended, around 1 or 2 in the afternoon, I'd head over to the ranch. There I'd work until the sun went down, study a bit, then go to bed. First thing in the morning, I'd feed all the horses, then head to class. Summer was the best. I'd be on horseback at 5 o'clock in the morning until 9 at night. Eventually, I became the two-year man, training cut horses and getting them ready for auction. Cutting horses, also called carving horses, sorting horses, whittlers, are trained to help cowboys cut cows from the herd. These working horses are important on a ranch, and a good one can be worth a good amount of money. This is really where I learned about dealing with horses and became much more patient than I had been before. If you lose your temper with a horse, you can ruin it for life. I taught myself to take my time and be gentle with them. Horses are extremely smart. They learn quickly, if you do it right. You show them something real small, then stop and do it again. A horse will lick its lips when it's learning. That's what I looked for. You stop the lesson on a good note and pick up the next day. Of course, it took a while to learn all this. Anytime I messed up, my boss would let me know. Right away, he'd cuss me out, tell me I was a worthless piece of shit. But I never got pissed at David. In my mind, I thought, I'm better than that, and I'll show you. As it happens, that's exactly the kind of attitude you need to become a SEAL. No from the Navy. Out there on the range, I had a lot of time and space to think about where I was headed. Studying and classes were not my thing. With my rodeo career ended, I decided that I would quit college, stop ranching, and go back to my original plan, join the military and become a soldier. Since that was what I really wanted to do, there was no sense waiting. And so, one day in 1996, I made my way to the recruiters, determined to sign up. This recruiting station was its own mini mall. The Army, Navy, Marine, Air Force offices were all lined up in a little row. Each one watched as you came in. They were in competition with each other, and not necessarily a friendly competition either. I went to the Marine door first, but they were out to lunch. As I turned around to leave, the Army guy down the hall called over. Hey, he said, why don't you come on in here? No reason not to, I thought, so I did. What are you interested in doing in the military? He asked. I told him that I liked the idea of special operations, and that from what I'd heard of Army SF, I thought I'd like to serve in that branch, if I were to join the Army, that is. Special Forces, or SF, is an elite unit in the Army charged with a number of special operations missions. The term Special Forces is sometimes used incorrectly to describe special operation troops in general, but when I use it, I mean the Army unit. At the time, you had to be an E-5, a sergeant, before you could be considered for SF. I didn't like the idea of waiting all that time before getting to the good stuff. You could be a ranger, suggested the recruiter. I didn't know too much about rangers, but what he told me sounded pretty enticing. Jumping out of airplanes, assaulting targets, becoming a small arms expert. He opened my eyes to the possibilities, though he didn't quite close the sale. I'll think about it, I said, getting up to leave. As I was on my way out, the Navy guy called to me from down the hall. Hey, you, he said, come on over here. I walked over. What were you talking about in there? He asked. I was thinking about going into SF, I said, but you have to be an E-5, so we were talking about the Rangers. Oh, yeah? Heard about the SEALs? At the time, the SEALs were still relatively unknown. I had heard a little about them, but I didn't know all that much. I think I shrugged. Why don't you come on in here, said the sailor. I'll tell you all about them. He started telling me about BUDS, or Basic Underwater Demolition Scuba Training, which is the preliminary school all SEALs must pass through. Nowadays, there are hundreds of books and movies on SEALs and BUDS. There's even a pretty long entry on our training in Wikipedia. But back then, BUDS was still a bit of a mystery, at least to me. When I heard how hard it was, how the instructors ran you, and how less than 10% of the class would qualify to move on, I was impressed. Just to make it through the training, you had to be one tough motherfucker. I liked that kind of challenge. Then the recruiter started telling me about all the missions SEALs and their predecessors, the UDTs, had completed. UDTs were members of underwater demolition teams, frogmen who scouted enemy beaches and undertook other special warfare assignments, beginning in World War II. There were stories about swimming between obstructions on Japanese-held beaches and gruesome fights behind the lines in Vietnam. It was all badass stuff, and when I left there, I wanted to be a SEAL in the worst way. Many recruiters, especially the good ones, have more than a little larceny in them, and this one was no different. When I came back and was about to sign the papers, he told me I had to turn down the signing bonus if I wanted to make sure I got the SEAL contract. I did. He was full of it, of course. Having me turn down the bonus made him look pretty good, I'm sure. I don't doubt he's got a great career ahead of him as a used car salesman. The Navy did not promise that I would be a SEAL. I had to earn that privilege. What they did guarantee, though, was that I would have a chance to try out. As far as I was concerned, that was good enough, because there was no way that I was going to fail. The only problem was that I didn't even get a chance to fail. The Navy disqualified me when my physical revealed that I had pins in my arm from the rodeo accident. I tried arguing, I tried pleading, nothing worked. I even offered to sign a waiver saying that I'd never make the Navy responsible for anything that happened to my arm. They flat out turned me down. And that, I concluded, was the end of my military career. The call. With the military ruled out, I focused on making a career out of ranching and being a cowboy. Since I already had a good job on a ranch, I decided there was really no sense staying in school. I quit, even though I was less than 60 credits shy of graduating. David doubled my pay and gave me more responsibilities. Larger offers eventually lured me to other ranches, though for different reasons I kept coming back to David's ranch. Eventually, just before the winter of 1997-98, I found my way out to Colorado. I took the job sight unseen, which turned out to be a big mistake. My thinking was, I'd been spending all my time in the Texas flatlands, and a move to the mountains would be a welcome change of scenery. Wouldn't you know it, I got a job at a ranch in the only part of Colorado flatter than Texas, and a good deal colder. It wasn't long before I called up David and asked if he needed some help. "Come on back," he told me. I started to pack, but I didn't get very far. Before I finished making arrangements to move, I got a phone call from a Navy recruiter. "Are you still interested in being a SEAL?" he asked. "Why?" "We want you," said the recruiter. "Even with the pins in my arm?" "Don't worry about that." I didn't. I started working on the arrangements right away. 2. Jackhammered. Welcome to BUDS.
"Drop 100 push-ups now."
220-some bodies hit the asphalt and started pumping. We were all in camis, camouflage BDUs or battle dress uniforms, with freshly painted green helmets. It was the start of BUDS training. We were bold, excited, and nervous as hell. We were about to get beat down, and we were loving it. The instructor didn't even bother to come out of his office inside the building a short distance away. His deep voice, slightly sadistic, carried easily out the hall into the courtyard where we were gathered.
"More push-ups! Give me 40! 40!"
My arms hadn't quite started to burn yet when I heard a strange hissing noise. I glanced up to see what was going on. I was rewarded with a blast of water in my face. Some of the other instructors had appeared and were working us over with fire hoses. Anyone stupid enough to look up got hosed. Welcome to Buds.
Flutter kicks, go!
BUDS stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL, and it is the introductory course that all candidates must pass to become SEALs. It's currently given at the Naval Special Warfare Center in Coronado, California. It starts with INDOC, or indoctrination, which is designed to introduce candidates to what will be required. Three phases follow: physical training, diving, land warfare. There have been a number of stories and documentaries over the years about BUDS and how tough it is. Pretty much everything they've said on that score is true. Or at least mostly true. The Navy and the instructors tone it down a bit for national consumption on TV reality shows and other broadcasts. Still, even the watered-down version is true enough. Essentially, the instructors beat you down, then beat you down some more. When that's done, they kick your ass and beat what's left down again. You get the idea. I loved it, hated it, loathed it, cursed it, but loved it. Lame and lamer. It had taken me the better part of a year to reach that point. I'd joined the Navy and reported for basic training in February 1999. Boot camp was pretty lame. I remember calling my dad at one point and saying that basic was easy compared to ranch work. That wasn't a good thing. I joined the Navy to be a SEAL and challenge myself. Instead, I got fat and out of shape. You see, boot camp is designed to prepare you to sit on a ship. They teach you a lot about the Navy, which is fine, but I wanted something more like the Marines' basic training, a physical challenge. My brother went into the Marines and came out of boot camp tough and in top condition. I came out and probably would have flunked BUDS if I'd gone straight in. They have since changed the procedure. There's now a separate BUDS boot camp, with more emphasis on getting and staying in shape. Lasting over a half year, BUDS is extremely demanding physically and mentally. As I mentioned earlier, the dropout rate can top 90%. The most notorious part of BUDS is Hell Week, 132 hours straight of exercise and physical activity. A few of the routines have changed and tested over the years, and I imagine they will continue to evolve. Hell Week has pretty much remained the most demanding physical test and probably will continue to be one of the high points, or low points, depending on your perspective. When I was in, Hell Week came at the end of first phase, but more about that later. Fortunately, I didn't go directly to BUDS. I had other training to get through first, and a shortage of instructors in the BUDS classes would keep me and many others from being abused for quite a while. According to Navy regs, I had to choose a specialty, or military occupation specialty, or MOS as it is known in the service, in case I didn't make it through BUDS and qualify for the SEALs. I chose intelligence. I naively thought I'd end up like James Bond. Have your little laugh. But it was during that training that I started working out more seriously. I spent 3 months learning the basics of the Navy's intelligence specialties and, more importantly, getting my body into better shape. It happened that I saw a bunch of real SEALs on the base, and they inspired me to work out. I would go to the gym and hit every vital part of my body: legs, chest, triceps, biceps, etc. I also started running 3 times a week, from 4 to 8 miles a day, jumping up 2 miles every session. I hated running, but I was beginning to develop the right mindset. Do whatever it takes. This was also where I learned how to swim, or at least how to swim better. The part of Texas I'm from is far from the water. Among other things, I had to master the side stroke, a critical stroke for a SEAL. When intel school ended, I was rounding into shape, but probably still not quite ready for BUDS. Though I didn't think so at the time, I was lucky that there was a shortage of instructors for BUDS, which caused a backlog of students. The Navy decided to assign me to help the SEAL detailers for a few weeks until there was an opening. Detailers are the people in the military who handle various personnel tasks. They're similar to human resources people in large corporations. I'd work about half a day with them, either from 8 to noon or noon to 4. When I wasn't working, I trained up with other SEAL candidates. We'd do PT, or physical training, what old-school gym teachers call calisthenics, for 2 hours. You know the drill, crunches, push-ups, squats. We stayed away from weight work. The idea was that you didn't want to get muscle-bound. You wanted to be strong, but have maximum flexibility. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we'd do exhaustion swim. Swim until you sink, basically. Fridays were long runs of 10 and 12 miles. Tough, but in Buds, you were expected to run a half marathon. My parents remember having a conversation with me around this time. I was trying to prepare them for what might lie ahead. They didn't know that much about SEALs. Probably a good thing. Someone had mentioned that my identity might be erased from official records. When I told them, I could see them grimace a little. I asked if they were okay with it. Not that they would really have a choice, I suppose. "It's okay," insisted my dad. My mom took it silently. They were both more than a little concerned, but they tried to hide it and never said anything to discourage me from going ahead. Finally, after 6 months or so of waiting, working out, and waiting some more, my orders came through. Report to Buds. Getting my ass kicked. I unfolded myself from the back seat of the cab and straightened my dress uniform. Hoisting my bag out of the taxi, I took a deep breath and started up the path to the quarter deck, the building where I was supposed to report. I was 24 years old, about to live my dream and get my ass kicked in the process. It was dark, but not particularly late, somewhere past 5 or 6 in the evening. I half expected I'd be jumped as soon as I walked in the door. You hear all these rumors about Buds and how tough it is, but you never get the full story. Anticipation makes things worse. I spotted a guy sitting behind a desk. I walked over and introduced myself. He checked me in and got me squared away with the room and the other administrative BS that needed to be handled. All the time I was thinking, this isn't too hard, and I'm going to get attacked any second. Naturally, I had trouble getting to sleep. I kept thinking the instructors were going to burst in and start whipping my ass. I was excited and a little worried at the same time. Morning came without the slightest disturbance. It was only then that I found out I wasn't really in Buds, not yet, not officially. I was in what is known as indoc, or indoctrination. Indoc is meant to prepare you for Buds. It's kind of like Buds with training wheels, if SEALs did training wheels. Indoc lasted a month. They did yell at us some, but it was nothing like Buds. We spent a bit of time learning the basics of what would be expected of us, like how to run the obstacle course. The idea was that by the time things got serious, we'd have our safety down. We spent a lot of time helping out in small ways as other classes went through the actual training. Indoc was fun. I loved the physical aspect, pushing my body and honing my skills. At the same time, I saw how the candidates were being treated in Buds, and I thought, oh shit, I better get serious and work out more. And then, before I knew it, first phase started. Now the training was for real. And my butt was being kicked, regularly, and with a great deal of feeling. Which brings us up to the point where we started this chapter, with me getting hosed in the face while working out. I had been doing PT for months, and yet this was far harder. The funny thing is, even though I knew more or less what was going to happen, I didn't completely understand how difficult it was going to be. Until you actually experience something, you just don't know. At some point that morning, I thought, holy shit, these guys are going to kill me. My arms are going to fall off, and I'm going to disintegrate right into the pavement. Somehow, I kept going. The first time the water hit me, I turned my face away. That earned me a lot of attention. Bad attention. "Don't turn away," shouted the instructor, adding a few choice words relating to my lack of character and ability. "Turn back and take it." So I did. I don't know how many hundreds of push-ups or other exercises we did. I do know that I felt I was going to fail. That drove me. I did not want to fail. I kept facing that fear, and coming to the same conclusion every day, sometimes several times. People ask about how tough the exercises were, how many push-ups we had to do, how many sit-ups. To answer the first question, the number was 100 each, but the numbers themselves were almost beside the point. As I recall, everyone could do 100 push-ups or whatever. It was the repetition and constant stress, the abuse that came with the exercises that made Bud so tough. I guess it's hard to explain if you haven't lived through it. There's a common misunderstanding that SEALs are all huge guys in top physical condition. That last part is generally true. Every SEAL in the teams is in excellent shape. But SEALs come in all sizes. I was in the area of 6'2" and 175 pounds. Others who would serve with me ranged from 5'7" on up to 6'6". The thing we all had in common wasn't muscle. It was the will to do whatever it takes. Getting through Buds and being a SEAL is more about mental toughness than anything else. Being stubborn and refusing to give in is the key to success. Somehow I'd stumbled onto the winning formula. Under the radar. That first week I tried to be as far under the radar as possible. Being noticed was a bad thing. Whether it was during PT or an exercise, or even just standing in line, the least little thing could make you the focus of attention. If you were slouching while in line, they fixed on you right away. If an instructor said to do something, I tried to be the first one to do it. If I did it right, and I sure tried to, they ignored me and went on to someone else. I couldn't completely escape notice, despite all my exercise, despite all the PT and everything else. I had a lot of trouble with pull-ups. I'm sure you know the routine. You put your arms up on the bar and pull yourself up. Then you lower yourself. Repeat. 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 In Buds, we had to hang from the bar and wait there until the instructor told us to start. Well, the first time the class set up, he happened to be standing right close to me. "Go," he said. "Ugh," I moaned, pulling myself northward. Big mistake. Right away, I got tagged as being weak. I couldn't do all that many pull-ups to begin with, maybe a half dozen, which was actually the requirement. But now, with all the attention, I couldn't just slip by. I had to do perfect pull-ups, and many of them. The instructor singled me out and started making me do more, and giving me a lot of extra exercise. It had an effect. Pull-ups became one of my better exercises. I could top 30 without trouble. I didn't end up the best in the class, but I wasn't an embarrassment either. And swimming? All the work I'd done before getting to Buds paid off. Swimming actually became my best exercise. I was one of, if not the fastest, swimmers in the class. Again, minimum distances don't really tell the story. To qualify, you have to swim 1,000 yards in the ocean. By the time you're done with Buds, 1,000 yards is nothing. You swim all the time. 2-mile swims were routine. And then there was the time we were taken out in boats and dropped off 7 nautical miles from the beach. "There's one way home, boys," said the instructors. "Start swimming." Meal to meal. Probably everyone who's heard of SEALs has heard of Hell Week. It's 5.5 days of continuous beatdown designed to see if you have the endurance and the will to become the ultimate warrior. Every SEAL has a different Hell Week story. Mine actually begins a day or two before Hell Week, out in the surf on some rocks. A group of us were in an IBS, inflatable boat small, your basic 6-man rubber dinghy, and we had to bring it ashore past those rocks. I was the point man, which meant it was my job to clamber out and hold the IBS tight while everyone else got off and picked it up. Well, just as I was getting set, a huge wave came up in the surf and took the boat and put it down on my foot. It hurt like hell, and immediately got numb. I ignored it as much as I could, and eventually wrapped it up. Later on, when we were finished for the day, I went with a buddy whose dad happened to be a doctor and had him check it out. He did an X-ray and found it was fractured. Naturally, he wanted to put it in a cast, but I refused to let him. Showing up at Bud's with the cast would mean I would have to put my training on hold, and if I did that before Hell Week, I'd have to go back to the very beginning, and no way was I going through everything I'd just been through again. Even during BUDS, you're allowed to leave base with permission during your time off, and obviously I didn't go to a Navy doctor to get the foot checked out because he would have sent me back, known as rollback, immediately. The night Hell Week was supposed to start, we were taken to a large room, fed pizza, and treated to a movie marathon, Black Hawk Down, We Were Soldiers, Braveheart. We were all relaxing in a non-relaxing kind of way, since we knew Hell Week was about to begin. It was like a party on the Titanic. The movies got us all psyched up, but we knew that iceberg was out there, looming in the dark. Once more, my imagination got me nervous. I knew at some point an instructor was going to burst through that door with an M60 machine gun shooting blanks, and I was going to have to run outside and form up on the grinder, asphalt workout area. But when? Every minute that passed added to the churning in my stomach. I was sitting there saying to myself, God, over and over, very eloquent and deep. I tried to take a nap, but I couldn't sleep. Finally, someone burst in and started shooting. Thank God. I don't think I've ever been so happy to be abused in my life. I ran outside. The instructors were throwing flash crashes and had the hoses going full blast. Flash crashes and flashbang grenades give off an intense flash and make a very loud noise when they explode, but won't injure you. Technically, the terms are applied to different grenades used by the Army and Navy, but we generally use the names interchangeably. I was excited, ready for what some people think is the ultimate test for SEAL trainees. But at the same time, I was thinking, what the hell is going on? Because even though I knew all about Hell Week, or thought I did, never having really experienced it, I really didn't understand it in my bones. We were split up. They sent us to different stations and we began doing push-ups, flutter kicks, star jumpers. After that, everything ran together. My foot? That was the least of the pain. We swam. We did PT. We took the boats out. Mostly, we just kept moving. One of the guys was so exhausted at one point, he thought a kayak coming to check on us in the boats was a shark and started yelling a warning. It was actually our commander. I'm not sure if he took that as a compliment or not. Before BUDS began, someone told me the best way to deal with it is to go meal to meal. Go as hard as you can until you get fed. They feed you every 6 hours, like clockwork. So I focused on that. Salvation was always no further than 5 hours and 59 minutes away. Still, there were several times I thought I wouldn't make it. I was tempted to get up and run over to the bell that would end my torture. If you ring this bell, you're taken in for coffee and a donut. And goodbyes, since ringing the bell, or even standing up and saying, I quit, means the end of the program for you. Believe it or not, my fractured foot gradually started to feel better as the week went on. Maybe I just became so used to the feeling that it became normal. What I couldn't stand was being cold. Lying out on the beach in the surf, stripped down, freezing my ass off, that was the worst. I'd lock my arms with the guys on either side of me and jackhammer, my body vibrating crazily with the chills. I prayed for someone to pee on me. Everybody did, I'm sure. Urine was about the only warm thing available at that point. If you happen to look out on the surf during a BUDS class and see a bunch of guys huddled together, it's because somebody out there is pissing and everybody's taking advantage of it. If that bell was a little closer, I might have stood up and gone and rung it, gotten my warm coffee and donut. But I didn't. Either I was too stubborn to quit or just too lazy to get up. Take your pick. I had all sorts of motivation to keep me going. I remembered every person who told me I'd flunk out of BUDS. Sticking in was the same as sticking it to them, and seeing all the ships off the coast was another incentive. I asked myself if I wanted to wind up out there. Hell no. Hell Week started on Sunday night. Come about Wednesday, I started feeling I was going to make it. By that point, my main goal was mostly to stay awake. I got about 2 hours of sleep that whole time, and they weren't together. A lot of the beating had gone away, and it was more a mental challenge than anything else. Many instructors say Hell Week is 90% mental, and they're right. You need to show that you have the mental toughness to continue on with the mission even when you're exhausted. That's really what the idea is behind the test. It's definitely an effective way of weeding out guys. I didn't see it at the time, to be honest. In combat, though, I understood. You can't just walk over and ring a bell to go home when you're being fired at.